Lights. Camera. Rolling. Quiet, please. And action. That's the sound we've heard around this church often over the years, as many great film shoots and lesser film shoots have taken place here. And that's the sound heard across the city, in this busy film-centered city, and across all the places that great films are made. Lights, camera, rolling, quiet please, and action. Prom Night 4 was filmed here. The Air Up There was filmed here. My office was the Ivy League office at one of the major American universities. Street Legal was filmed in the basement here, and I can still see our care staff wiping off the fake blood from the ceiling before the children from the nursery school realized what it was. The Battlestar Galactica was filmed here, and at one point they created a whole wall of fake glass across the transept, and at 8 o'clock in the evening they were going to break it with a hammer and then lay in later the fact that it was laser beams from space that had destroyed it. It was Thursday night and choir rehearsal, and at 8 o'clock, 32 little children, all members of the adult choir, stood with great anticipation as the ceiling was cracked and the glass fell. Lights, camera, action. Well, we heard that Sylvester Stallone was coming to film here once, and there were several directives sent about him. No one is to speak to him, and no one is to look at him. You can't look at Sylvester Stallone. It throws him off his lines. And so he was to arrive at noon in the parking lot, come directly into the church for the shoot, and wouldn't you know it, you couldn't find any staff members inside the building at 11:45. All the staff members were outside, not looking at Sylvester Stallone. They were looking at the grass and the flowers and seeing how the fencing was standing up, and then suddenly an SUV rolled into the place, and out stepped a short little man in a white shirt with black hair, surrounded by four great tree trunks of men in buckskin jackets, looking very, very dour. And into the church he went. Well, an old woman wandered over from the hospital and said, "What's going on?" And we said, "You just missed Sylvester Stallone." "Oh, dear," she said, "I do love Sylvester Stallone. My husband's in having his heart checked, and I have to wait for him all day. I'm so sorry I missed it." Well, I came into the church later, and one of our care staff, who likes to take care of me, said, "Why don't we go in and look for Sylvester Stallone? Come on, it'll be all right." So he and I walked in, and there was Sylvester Stallone standing in the other transept. And suddenly one of the great tree trunks with the buckskin jacket stood up and pointed his finger and said, "You, out." And I ran like a rabbit through my own church and out the back door. So much for the power of film. The Gospels are like whirlpools when you think about it. They start slowly away out at the edge as a delightful story, the miraculous birth of a beautiful young child, or the beginnings of the ministry of a very compelling young man whom people are willing to hear and to follow. But then the whirlpool picks up a little bit, and then more exciting things begin to happen, and then the teaching gets a little more strident, and then those who begin to hear what's being said rise up in opposition, and before long you're whirling towards the center of things, and you know it's not going to be very nice. But that's how we work, isn't it? We lay meaning over the bare bones of things. We see someone walk into our life and we begin to say, what is this person going to mean to us over time? Or we hear a wonderful phrase or an idea and we say, I wonder how this phrase or idea is going to change my life. And over time, because we work at it, friendship becomes a miracle and advice given quietly on a given day becomes wisdom that changes us forever, and a cruel death on a cross becomes transformation that redeems the cosmos. The whirlpool whirls and draws us deeper and deeper into it. Lights, camera, rolling, quiet please, and action. The prophetic passage from Jeremiah displays the light of profound promise. The prophet says, the days are coming. And he repeats it, the days are coming. Soon, for sure, guaranteed, deliverance is coming. The one who rescues and restores us is coming. The end of family dysfunction is coming. Don't we long to hear that in the culture in which we are living? The days of restoration are coming. I visited one of our members once in the hospital. He had had a heart attack, and it was his second one, and he was feeling that his life was coming to an end. He was assured in the middle of the night by the person in the next bed, who happened to be an Anglican priest, that he would make it through the darkness. And in the morning, when I met him, he said, the most wonderful thing happened to me in the night. Something came to me and removed the fear in my life and replaced it with a profound sense of belonging, pushed all the junk in my life, all the things I'd accumulated over the years and for which I was blaming myself, pushed them all out of the way like cardboard boxes in a dusty attic, and I found myself to be loved. And then he said, I had the most remarkable day. My whole family came to see me. I have a grandson who always scowls, who never smiles. He's very quiet, and we sit looking at each other in a stiff sort of way. Well, he came, and we laughed, and we talked all morning long. And the whole family came and visited, and at the end of the day, just at the end of visiting hours, I looked down into the darkness, and there was my youngest daughter standing at the bottom of the bed. She and I had been alienated from each other for years. Not that we didn't love each other. It's just that we were so alike that we banged heads all the time. And we sat and we talked and we mended fences and we told each other how much we loved each other. The perfect day, the day is coming, said Jeremiah the prophet. We may not know when or how, but the tales of our dysfunction and sadness are about to be transformed, said the prophet. Well, it's going to involve a new covenant, he said. The first covenant was one of debt. Look, I bring you out of Egypt and you owe me. That's not a nice way to live most of the time. You have a feeling it's sort of like the extortionist drops into your place every 2 weeks for the payment so your windows don't get broken. Remember, I brought you out of Egypt and you owe me. I rescued you. Now, I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for my rescue from my enslavements, but I don't want to feel compelled that that's my only attitude in life and that I owe something always to the one who rescued me. It becomes cloying after a while. It's like being in a relationship or in a marriage that's suddenly gone bad over the years, but you made a commitment, you made a promise, you don't really want to be there, he or she doesn't really, really want to be there, but no one is able to say, I need a new covenant, I need a new beginning. There was a program last week, I was listening to it on the way down to the country. It was a program about the story of a young musician living in Toronto. When he was a child, he loved to sing, and his mother, who was a bit of a wild thing, loved for him to sing as well, and they used to sing together. And a few years later, when he reached his teen years, he discovered a book inside a cupboard drawer, and he showed it to his mother and said, is this a Bible? And she said, oh my God, it's a Quran. I'd forgotten about that. He said, I never knew we were religious. And my mother turned and became a fundamentalist member of the Islamic community. She went to the most fundamental setting she could find, and she planted me there. And there was no singing, and there was no music, and there was no being gay, and there I was. And over the years, my mother forbade me to listen to music, to listen to my favorite CDs. I could no longer compose things. I sat in silence and went as often as I was told to the mosque. After a while, he said, when I reached about 16 years old, I actually did a pirouette in the mosque one day, and several people turned on me and said, we don't do that here, and we don't welcome gay people here either. He said, I'm older now, and I left home, and I live with my grandmother, and I make music. And now he is becoming known, and his music is being appreciated in the city and beyond. The interviewer said, what does your mother think about your music? He said, "My mother and I never speak of it." A new covenant. Not a covenant in which you owe me because I gave life to you. A covenant which says, "This is a new beginning for you. I am in you, and you are in me." Did you see the picture on Facebook and in the newspapers of 3-year-old Parker Curry from North Carolina, a little Afro-American girl standing in the National Portrait Museum in Washington, D.C., transfixed by the new portrait of Michelle Obama? Did you see that? Someone snapped the picture of her because her mother was saying, "Turn around, Parker, turn around. I want to take a picture of turn around." And the little kid would not break her stare. The little child stood there with her arms at her side, leaning forward, staring up into the face of Michelle Obama. And someone took a picture of that, and it went viral. All over the world, people were looking at this little child transfixed. And the next morning, the grandmother of the little girl said, "Well, you must be a big star now." And she said, "No, I'm a big girl." No one can break that look. No one can break that sense of belonging, because there is a light inside us that inspires us. And when we look at something and it moves us, we see it. A new covenant. This is who I am. This is what I must do. These are the values I shall own, and I shall live with them in my life. I feel that this church, on its best days, and we have very, very many best days, stand in front of a portrait of an even greater church, and we are transfixed by it, and we say in the face of it, "This is who I am. This is our calling. This is what I shall be." And whatever darkness comes on the days ahead, we know that the light is real. The story of the prodigal son illustrates that for me. I was thinking about it. My wife Elspeth and I were going through the crosswords the other day. I get 3 of them and she gets 49 of them. That's just the way we live. And the clue ended up being the word prodigal. And I think the clue word was wasteful. And I would never have picked that up. I didn't know prodigal meant wasteful. She said, "You've been a minister for 48 years. You didn't know prodigal meant wasteful?" "No, I thought it meant somebody who wandered off." No, it's wasteful," she said. Well, this is the story of the wasteful son. And the lesson of the story is, here is the boy coming back to the first covenant. "I know I owe you, and I know I owe you, and I know you rescued me, and I know I have to measure up," and on and on and on it goes. But while he was a long way off, the father saw him running and came running to him and threw his arms around his neck and kissed him and yelled to the servants, "Bring out the ring, bring out the robe, kill the fatted calf, for my boy who was lost has been found. It isn't about your regret. You are home here. I love you. Your life is what I love. This is the covenant under which we shall live." Well, the camera part of lights, camera, and action is the lens through which we see the fact of unavoidable suffering. I'm sorry to have to say it, but if we're going to be people of faith, we're going to face inevitable suffering. Jesus' death was an unimaginably cruel death. The Romans saved crucifixion for the most rebellious, the least in the kingdom, and the worst of offenders. They would be stripped and beaten and starved, and in their weakness made to carry their own crosspiece to the place of crucifixion. Then they would have their feet nailed with one nail onto a small stand and nailed through their wrists onto the crossbeam. Then their hands would be tied. They would be hiked up about 4 or 5 feet off the ground, naked, and they would stand there, leaning, pushing up on their own feet to take the pressure off their chests, being jeered at by the crowd and mocked by those who were coming by them almost at eye level, and they would hang there until they could carry their weight no longer and suffocated on their own lungs. And then at the end, the indignity would be complete by the Roman soldiers breaking their legs to make sure they were dead. The writers of the gospel say, "Do you see? The abyss between sin and restoration is deep and wide, and the cost of crossing it is great." Last week at One Question Bible Study, I read a small portion from a psalm, and the question was, what do you feel is the best expression of discipline in your life? The psalm text said, God said to the people, you will not accept discipline from me. I speak to you, and you go ahead and do all the things you want anyway, and you will not accept discipline. Don't think I'm not watching you, said God in the psalm. I'm watching you, and I'm coming. And I said to our small group in the One Question Bible Study, what is the best expression of discipline? How do we experience and express our discipline in the face of the hand of the Almighty? An interesting question, I thought. And then I thought, what a terrible person I am. I hate asking myself my own questions. I'm a very poor high priest. I realized I don't want to know about pain in my life or in other people's lives very much. I don't want the implications of poor choices pouring themselves all over me and my little piece. I don't want to read the fine print and find that people are not as trustworthy as I might have thought, or the deal isn't as good as I would have hoped. I don't want to feel the irritational fury in the face of arrogance and stupidity and injustice when I see it in systems and other people, and I see it. But to treat painful complexities of human life with some kind of wallpaper solution and cheap scorn is an insult. It is necessary to ask the questions of why evil exists and to find out the legitimate reasons for people's social rage. It is essential to fight for real people in the complexity of life and not just to lay out doctrinal and moralistic laws that make me and mine feel better. I'm not very good at it, and I realized it when the question came up. The writer of the letter to the Hebrews presents a Christ who is a great high priest for us. He's writing to a Jewish audience, a great high priest who has been tempered by suffering. Jesus Christ, he says, has paid the price of being alive. I guess meeting a man among tombs can tell you pretty quickly how a culture can crush somebody. Sitting with a man among tombs who is chained and cutting himself with knives is a pretty tough scene. And to embrace a leper in front of a horrified crowd that feels only revulsion will tell you a whole lot about what the range of loving somebody is. And raising a little girl from the dead and restoring her to her grieving family will certainly show you things about ourselves we didn't know we possessed. But for every caring deed and every kind word in the world, there is a hardcore resistance from somebody somewhere. The suffering is real for those who try to alleviate it. If you're going to be a person of faith, you're going to suffer. The Christ who dared to love deeply and to teach is going to end up on a cross. You know it's true. If you see a truth, it's going to cost you to live it. You will become a target. One of our members gave me the book to read called Red Notice by Bill Browder. Bill Browder was an economist, someone involved in big banking and international money, and he spent the last 10 years of his life tracking down Vladimir Putin and the Russian oligarchs and their corruption, and he wrote about it. He is a hunted man. He was interviewed the other day from his home in New York and said that he had been on Vladimir Putin's hit list for 9 years. He is on a death list put out by the president of Russia. The interviewer said, "Have you taken steps for your own protection?" He said, "Yes." And the interviewer said, "What are they?" And he said, "I'm not going to tell the CBC what my steps are so they can come and get me next week. Just trust that I'm taking them." And he said, "I live with the threat of death every day, but I know that the corruption about which I write must be rooted out for the sake of the world, and so we go on." Tremendous courage. If you name names, and if you tell inconvenient truths, and if you go to a public that's willing to hear you, you're going to make enemies. The camera focuses on the suffering required by the high priest of faith. The gospel of Christ is not simply that we believe and go to heaven. That's too easy. It's not an Uber black car ride to an exclusive party somewhere. The gospel of Christ is armed with these words. We find them in the book of the prophet Amos. "I am setting a plumb line in the midst of my people. I will never pass them by again. Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-rolling stream." Tell that to unbridled self-interest and to financial collusion. Tell that to the duplicitous power players and the sexual predators. Name the shame and you will feel the pain. There is the mantra of a faithful life. People who tell truths are not heard. Children who name abuse are often silenced. Churches that protest and speak out are regarded as subversive. Stick to your funny, dusty little book, they say. Sing your silly hymns on a Sunday, but stay out of the way of the real people with the real power. Well, Jesus was crucified because he was a threat to power. He said the wrong things at the wrong time to the wrong crowd, and everybody knew he was right. Then comes the word action. Amazing grace released into the wide world. That's the action of all this. Amazing grace is defined as the unmerited love of God. Simply that, the unmerited love of God. Suddenly, we know it's real. Suddenly, we're not alone and we're not forgotten. Suddenly, we feel that our days are full of potential and we are in the presence of a living spirit, a covenant written on our hearts, as Jeremiah said. No longer will you have to teach each other, know the Lord. You will all know the Lord from the greatest to the least. The fully engaged life of the high priest has been lived for us and has died for us and has been raised from the dead. We are blessed. Now, one of the joys of growing old is that you can look back and see the faces of those who have blessed you and helped you along the way. They may be superstars to us, and we think about them every day, or they may be gentler faces that simply smile at us from wherever they may be. And I was thinking this week of Grace Fleury. Now, you didn't know Grace Fleury. I hardly knew Grace Fleury. When I was a little boy, my mother knew Grace Fleury. Grace Fleury was an old, white-haired woman, small and a powerhouse, I recall. She was the director of Dixon Hall in those days, and she organized things for the community and for young women and children in the community. And my mother looked up to her, and I looked up to my mother. And the action of amazing grace flowed through Grace Fleury into my mother and somehow trickled by osmosis, I'm sure, into me a little bit. Now, it's very hard to go through the rest of Lent, isn't it? Because we know how this thing is going to go. It's going to go into the lash and to the spitting and to the degradation and the death. And we were going to stand again this year in mute frustration before a Pilate who could have released Jesus with a wave of his hand, but did not. And we read of the lash of war around us and the spittle of dysfunction and the crucifixion by race and gender and ethnicity and age and all the rest of it. And it's hard enough to live in life, let alone repeat it all in Sunday liturgy. It's too stark. It's too hard to bear. Nails through tender flesh, mockery on the lips of hardened crowds. The liturgy is hard enough to bear, but the real life situations are worse. So people give the foot washing gesture in Holy Week services here a bit of a miss, and the Seder meal, well, a few of us come, but the rest, it's a bit of a miss, that transition out of slavery into freedom, not quite our tradition. And then the Good Friday service, well, lots of people all over the city give the Good Friday service a miss. It's too dark, it's too plain, it's too hard. Just tell us about Easter Sunday. We really need to hear Easter Sunday. And yet we live in a world in which millions have no mentor, no shelter, no prospects, no work, no money, no support, no tomorrow. I think it's the story of the raising of Lazarus that really, really perhaps gives the best scene into which to play lights, camera, and action. A community has been oppressed. A loved one has died unshriven. And then into the scene comes Jesus, not simply the first century Jewish teacher, but the profound and transformative instrument of the living God, cutting through the rage, brushing away the bitter tears, facing the brutal stench of death 4 days in the tomb and calling out the man by his name, by his nature, by the power of his own being. Lazarus, his name means God has helped. Isn't that perfect writing by John? God has helped. He certainly has. He raised a dead man to life. Come out, says the command, grace abounding, light adorning, the darkness is over. Unbind him and let him go, says Jesus, to the crowd and to us as well. See the true world in which you are living. Now, the surprise at the end of that film shoot with Sylvester Stallone was the most amazing one indeed. In mid-afternoon, they all took a break, and the staff were still outside at the periphery, not looking at Sylvester Stallone. And there in the middle of it all, standing in the center among the four tree trunks, glowering as usual, was Sylvester Stallone talking to the woman from the hospital. She went over and talked to him for 15 minutes, a little chit-chat, Sylvester and the woman from the hospital. And then they went back in to shoot. And then she said, I can't believe that. I got to talk to Sylvester Stallone. When I tell my husband when he comes out of his heart check, he's not going to believe it either. I said, well, why don't you tell your husband that Sylvester Stallone made a pass at you? I mean, if you're going to tell him something he doesn't believe, you might as well make it a good one. Well, she laughed, and I laughed as well. Unbind yourself to see the scene in which you really live. A new covenant on the inside, and a high priest around on the outside, who knows about our suffering, and who brings transformation to our lives. Lights, camera rolling, quiet please, and...